trying to get my bearings. I hear tendons creaking and snapping. Then I see a knee. Then Earl's face.
"You still down there?"
he says, peering under the bunk. "Yeah, sorry." I shimmy out and struggle to my feet. "Hallelujah," says my host, stretching out. "Od pier dolcia," I say. A snort of laughter comes from a bunk a few feet away.
"Come on," says Earl. "Al's had enough to loosen him up, but not enough to get mean. I figure this is your opportunity."
He leads me through two more sleeping cars. When we reach the platform at the end, we're facing the back of a different kind of car. Through its window, I can see burnished wood and intricate light fixtures. Earl turns to me.
"You ready?"
"Sure," I say. I'm not. He grabs me by the scruff and smashes my face into the door frame. With his other hand, he yanks open the sliding door and chucks me inside. I fall forward, my hands outstretched. I come to a stop against a brass rail and straighten up, looking back at Earl in shock. And then I see the rest of them.
"What is this?" says Uncle Al from the depths of a winged chair. He is seated at a table with three other men, twaddling a fat cigar between the finger and thumb of one hand and holding five fan cards in the other. A snifter of brandy rests on the table in front of him. Just beyond it is a large pile of poker chips.
"Jumped the train, sir. Found him sneaking through a sleeper."
"Is that a fact?"
says Uncle Al. He takes a leisurely drag from his cigar and sets it on the edge of a standing ashtray. He sits back, studying his cards and letting smoke waft from the corners of his mouth.
"I'll see you three and raise you five," he says, leaning forward and flinging a stack of chips into the kitty.
"You want I should show him the door?"
says Earl. He advances and lifts me from the floor by the lapels. I tense and close my fists around his wrists, intending to hang on if he tries to throw me again. I look from Uncle Al to the lower half of Earl's face, which is all I can see, and then back again. Uncle Al folds his cards and sets them carefully on the table.
"Not yet, Earl," he says. He reaches for a cigar and takes another drag. "Set him down."
Earl lowers me to the floor with my back to Uncle Al. He makes a half-hearted attempt to smooth my jacket.
"Step forward," says Uncle Al.
I oblige, happy enough to be out of Earl's reach.
"I don't believe I've had the pleasure," he says, blowing a smoke ring. "What's your name?"
Jacob Jankowski, sir.
"And what, pray tell, does Jacob Jankowski think he is doing on my train?"
"I'm looking for work," I say. Uncle Al continues to stare at me. Blowing lazy smoke rings, he rests his hands on his belly, drumming a slow beat on his waistcoat.
"Ever worked on a show, Jacob?"
"No, sir."
"Ever been to a show, Jacob?"
"Yes, sir, of course."
"Which one?"
"Ringling Brothers," I say. A sharp intake of breath causes me to turn my head. Earl's eyes are wide and warning. "But it was terrible." "Just terrible," I add hastily, turning back to Uncle Al.
"Is that a fact?" says Uncle Al.
"Oh, yes, sir."
"And have you seen our show, Jacob?"
"Yes, sir," I say, feeling a blush spread across my cheeks.
"And what did you think of it?"
he asks.
"It was spectacular." "What was your favorite act?"
I grasp wildly, pulling details out of the air. "The one with the black and white horses and the girl in pink," I say, with the sequins.
"You hear that, August? The boy likes your Marlena."
The man opposite Uncle Al rises and turns. He's the man from the menagerie tent, only now he's minus the top hat. His chiseled face is impassive, his dark hair shiny with pomade. He also has a mustache, but unlike Uncle Al's, his lasts only the length of his lip.
"So, what exactly is it that you envision yourself doing?" asks Uncle Al.
He leans forward and lifts his snifter from the table. He swirls its contents and drains it in a single gulp. A waiter emerges from nowhere and refills it.
"I'll do just about anything, but if possible, I'd like to work with animals."
"Animals?"
he says.
"You hear that, August?
lad wants to work with animals. You want to carry water for elephants, I suppose.
Earl's brow creases.
But, sir, we don't have any. Shut up!
Shrieks Uncle Al, leaping to his feet. His sleeve catches the snifter and knocks it to the carpet. He stares at it, his fists clenched and face growing darker and darker. Then he bares his teeth and screams a long, inhuman howl, bringing his foot down on the glass again and again and again. There's a moment of stillness, broken only by the rhythmic clacking of ties passing beneath us. Then the waiter drops to the floor and starts scooping up glass. Uncle Al takes a deep breath and turns to the window with his hands clasped behind him. When he eventually turns back to us, his face is once again pink. A smirk plays around the edges of his lips.
I'm going to tell you how it is, Jacob Jankowski.
He spits my name out like something distasteful.
I've seen your sort 1,000 times. You think I can't read you like a book? So what's the deal? Did you and Mommy have a fight? Or maybe you're just looking for a little adventure between semesters?
No, sir, nothing like that.
I don't give a damn what it is. Even if I gave you a job on the show, you wouldn't survive. Not for a week. Not for a day. The show is a well-oiled machine, and only the toughest make it. But then you wouldn't know anything about tough, would you, Mr. College Boy?
He glares at me as though challenging me to speak.
Now, piss off, he says, waving me away. Earl, show him the door. Wait till you actually see a red light before chucking him off. I don't want to catch any heat for hurting Mommy's little baby.
Hang on a moment, Al, says August.
He's smirking, clearly amused.
Is he right? Are you a college boy?
I feel like a mouse being bounced between cats. I was.
And what did you study? Something in the fine arts, perhaps?
His eyes gleam in mockery.
Romanian folk dancing? Aristotelian literary criticism? Or perhaps, Mr. Jankowski, you completed a performance degree on the accordion?
I studied veterinary sciences. His mien changes instantly, utterly.
Vet school? You're a vet?
Not exactly.
What do you mean, not exactly?
I never wrote my final exams.
Why not?
I just didn't.
And those final exams, those were in your final year?
Yes.
What college?
Cornell. August and Uncle Al exchange glances.
Marlena said Silver Star was off,
says August.
Wanted me to get the advance man to arrange for a vet. Didn't seem to understand that the advance man was gone out in advance. Hence the name.
What are you suggesting?
Says Uncle Al.
Let the kid have a look in the morning.
And where do you propose we put him for tonight? We're already past capacity.
He snatches his cigar from the ashtray and taps it on the edge.
I suppose we could just send him out on the flats.
I was thinking more along the lines of the Ring stock car, says August.
Uncle Al frowns.
What? With Marlena's horses?
Yes.
You mean in the area where the goats used to be? Isn't that where that little shit sleeps? Oh, what's his name?
He says, snapping his fingers.
Stinko, Kanko, and that clown with the dog.
Precisely,
smiles August. August leads me back through the men's bunk cars until we're standing on a small platform facing the back of a stock car.
Are you sure-footed, Jacob?
He inquires graciously. I believe so, I answer.
Good,
he says. Without further ado, he leans forward, catches hold of something around the side of the stock car, and climbs nimbly to the roof.
Jesus Christ,
I yell, looking in alarm, first at the point where August disappeared, and then down at the bare coupling and ties that race beneath the cars. The train jerks around a curve. I throw my hands out to keep my balance, breathing hard.
Come on, then,
yells a voice from the roof.
How the hell did you do that? What did you grab?
There's a ladder. Just around the side. Lean forward and reach for it. You'll find it.
What if I don't?
Then I guess we'll take our leave, won't we?
I advance gingerly to the edge. I can see just the edge of a thin iron ladder. I train my eyes on it and wipe my hands on my thighs. Then I tip forward. My right hand meets ladder. I grasp wildly with my left until I ensnare the other side. I jam my feet in the rungs and cling tightly, trying to catch my breath.
Well, come on then.
I look up. August peers down at me, grinning, his hair blowing in the wind. I climb to the roof. He moves over, and when I sit down next to him, he claps a hand on my shoulder.
Turn around. I want you to see something.
He points down the length of the train. It stretches behind us like a giant snake, the linked cars jiggling and bending as it rounds a curve.
It's a beautiful sight, isn't it, Jacob?
Says August. I look back at him. He's staring right at me, his eyes glowing.
Not quite as beautiful as my Marlena, though, hey, hey?
He clicks his tongue and winks. Before I can protest, he stands and tap dances across the roof. I crane my neck and count stock cars. There are at least six. August?
What?
He says, stopping mid-twirl. Which car is Kinko in? He crouches suddenly.
This one. Aren't you a lucky boy?
He pries off a roof vent and disappears. I scuttle over on hands and knees. August?
What?
Returns a voice from the darkness. Is there a ladder?
No, just drop down.
I lower myself inside until I'm hanging by my fingertips. Then I crash to the floor. A surprised knicker greets me. Thin strips of moonlight filter through the slatted sides of the stock car. On one side of me is a line of horses. The other side is blocked by a wall that is clearly homemade. August steps forward and shoves the door inward. It crashes against the wall behind it, revealing a makeshift room lit by kerosene lamp. The lamp is on an upturned crate next to a cot. A dwarf is lying on his stomach with a thick book open in front of him. He is about my age, and like me, has red hair. Unlike me, his stands straight up from his head, an unruly thatch. His face, neck, arms, and hands are heavily freckled.
Kinko,
says August in disgust.
August, says the dwarf, equally disgusted. This is Jacob, August says, taking a tour of the tiny room.
He leans over and fingers things as he passes.
He's going to bunk with you for a while.
I step forward, holding out my hand.
How do you do? I say.
Kinko regards my hand coolly and then looks back at August.
What is he? His name is Jacob. I said what, not who? He's going to help out in the menagerie.
Kinko leaps to his feet.
A menagerie man? Forget it. I'm a performer. There's no way I'm bunking with a working man.
There's a growl from behind him, and for the first time, I see the Jack Russell Terrier. She's standing on the end of the cot with her hackles raised.
I am the equestrian director and superintendent of animals, August says slowly. And it is by the grace of my generosity that you are allowed to sleep here at all. It is also by the grace of my generosity that it's not filled with roustabouts. Of course, I can always change that. Besides, this, gentlemen, is the show's new veterinarian, from Cornell, no less, which puts him a good deal higher than you, in my estimation. Perhaps you'd like to consider offering him the cot.
The lamp's flame flickers in August's eyes. His lip quivers in its shadowy glow. After a moment, he turns to me and bows low, clicking his heels.
Good night, Jacob. I'm sure Kinko will make you comfortable. Won't you, Kinko?
Kinko glowers at him. August smooths both sides of his hair with his hands. Then he leaves, pulling the door shut behind him. I stare at the rough-hewn wood until I hear his footsteps clatter over top of us. Then I turn around. Kinko and the dog are staring at me. The dog lifts her lip and snarls. I spend the night on a crumpled horse blanket against the wall, as far from the cot as I can.
The blanket is damp. Whoever covered the slats when they turned this into a room did a lousy job, so the blanket's been rained on and reeks of mildew. I wake with a start. I've scratched my arms and neck raw. I don't know if it's from sleeping on horsehair or vermin, and don't want to know. The sky that shows between the patched slats is black, and the train is still moving. I awoke because of a dream, but I can't recall specifics. I close my eyes, reaching tentatively for the corners of my mind. It's my mother. She's standing in the yard in a cornflower blue dress, hanging laundry on the line. She has wooden clothes pegs in her mouth, and more in an apron tied around her waist. Her fingers are busy with a sheet. She's singing quietly in Polish. Flash. I'm lying on the floor, looking up at the stripper's dangling breasts. Her nipples brown and the size of silver dollar pancakes swing in circles. Out and around, slap. Out and around, slap. I feel a pang of excitement, then remorse, and then nausea. And then I'm...
Chapter 5.
I'm blubbering like the ancient fool I am, that's what. I guess I was asleep. I could have sworn that just a few seconds ago, I was 23. And now here I am in this wretched, desiccated body. I sniff and wipe my stupid tears, trying to pull myself together because that girl is back. The plump one in pink. She either worked all night or I lost track of a day. I hate not knowing which. I also wish I could remember her name, but I can't. That's how it is when you're 90. Or 93. Good morning, Mr. Jankowski, the nurse says, flipping on the light. She walks to the window and adjusts the horizontal blinds to let in sunlight. Time to rise and shine. What for? I grumble. Because the good Lord has seen fit to bless you with another day, she says, coming to my side. She presses a button on my bed rail. My bed starts to hum. A few seconds later, I'm sitting upright. Besides, you're going to the circus tomorrow. The circus? So I haven't lost a day. She pops a disposable cone on a thermometer and sticks it in my ear. I get poked and prodded like this every morning. I'm like a piece of meat unearthed from the back of the fridge, suspect until proven otherwise. After the thermometer beeps, the nurse flicks the cone into the wastebasket and writes something on my chart. Then she pulls the blood pressure cuff from the wall. So, do you want to have breakfast in the dining room this morning, or would you like me to bring you something here? She asks, wrapping the cuff around my arm and inflating it. I don't want breakfast. Come now, Mr. Jankowski, she says, pressing the stethoscope to the inside of my elbow and watching the gauge. You've got to keep your strength up. I try to catch sight of her name tag. What for? So I can run a marathon? So you don't catch something and miss the circus, she says. After the cuff deflates, she removes the apparatus from my arm and hangs it back on the wall. Finally, I can see her name. I'll have it in here then, Rosemary, I say, thereby proving that I remember her name. Keeping up the appearance of having all your marbles is hard work but important. Anyway, I'm not really addled. Might just have more facts to keep track of than other people. I do declare you're as strong as a horse, she says, writing one last thing down before flipping my chart shut. If you keep your weight up, I'll bet you could go on another 10 years. Swell, I say. When Rosemary comes to park me in the hallway, I ask her to take me to the window so I can watch the goings-on at the park. It's a beautiful day, with the sun streaming down between puffy clouds. Just as well. I remember all too well what it's like to work on a circus lot when the weather is foul. Not that the work is anything like what it used to be. I wonder if they're even called roustabouts anymore. And sleeping quarters sure have improved. Just look at those RVs. Some of them even have portable satellite dishes attached to them. Shortly after lunch, I spot the first nursing home resident being wheeled up the street by relatives. 10 minutes later, there's a veritable wagon train. There's Ruthie. Oh, Nellie Compton, too. What's the point? She's a turnip. She won't remember a thing. And there's Doris. That must be her Randall she's always talking about. And there's that bastard McGinty. Oh, yeah. Cock of the walk, with his family surrounding him in a plaid blanket spread over his knees. Spouting elephant stories, no doubt. There's a line of glorious percherons behind the big top, every one of them gleaming white. Maybe they're for vaulting? Horses and vaulting acts are always white, so that the powdered rosin that makes the performer's feet stick to their backs won't show. Even if it is a liberty act, there's no reason to think it could hold a candle to Marlena's. There's nothing and no one who could compare to Marlena. I look for an elephant, with equal parts dread and disappointment. The wagon train returns later in the afternoon, with balloons tied to their chairs and silly hats on their heads. Some even hold bags of cotton candy in their laps. Bags! For all they know, the floss could be a week old. In my day, it was fresh, spun from a drum onto a paper cone. At 5 o'clock, a slim nurse with a horse face comes to the end of the hall. "Are you ready for your dinner, Mr. Jankowski?" she says, kicking off my brakes and spinning me around. "Ah," I say, cranky that she didn't wait for an answer. When we get to the dining room, she steers me toward my usual table. "No, wait," I say. "I don't want to sit there tonight." "Don't worry, Mr. Jankowski," she says. "I'm sure Mr. McGinty has forgiven you for last night." "Yeah, well, I haven't forgiven him. I want to sit over there," I say, pointing at another table. "But there's nobody at that table," she says. "Exactly." "Oh, Mr. Jankowski, why don't you just let me?" "Just put me where I asked you to, damn it." My chair stops, and there is dead silence from behind it. After a few seconds, we start moving again. The nurse parks me at my chosen table and leaves. When she returns to plunk a plate down in front of me, her lips are pursed primly. The main difficulty with sitting at a table by yourself is that there's nothing to distract you from hearing the other people's conversations. I'm not eavesdropping. I just can't help hearing it. Most of them are talking about the circus, and that's okay. What's not okay is that old fart McGinty sitting at my regular table with my lady friends and holding court like King Arthur. And that's not all. Apparently he told someone who worked for the circus that he used to carry water for the elephants, and they upgraded his ticket to a ringside seat. Incredible. And there he sits, yammering on and on about the special treatment he received, while Hazel, Doris, and Norma stare adoringly. I can stand it no longer. I look down at my plate. stewed something under pale gravy with a side of pockmarked jello. Nurse, I bark. Nurse! One of them looks up and catches my eye. Since it's clear I'm not dying, she takes her sweet time getting to me. What can I do for you, Mr. Jankowski? How about getting me some real food? I beg your pardon? Real food. You know, that stuff people on the outside get to eat. Oh, Mr. Jankowski. Don't you owe Mr. Jankowski me, young lady? This is nursery food. And last I looked, I wasn't 5 years old. I'm 90. Or 93. It's not nursery food. Yes, it is. There's no substance. Look, I say, dragging my fork through the gravy-covered heap. It falls off and glops, leaving me holding a coated fork. You call that food? I want something I can sink my teeth into, something that crunches. And what exactly is this supposed to be? I say, poking the lump of red jello. It jiggles outrageously, like a breast I once knew. It's salad. Salad? Do you see any vegetables? I don't see any vegetables. It's fruit salad, she says, her voice steady but forced. Do you see any fruit? Yes, as a matter of fact, I do, she says, pointing at a pock. There and there. That's a piece of banana, and that's a grape. Why don't you try it? Why don't you try it? She folds her arms across her chest. The schoolmarm has run out of patience. This food is for the residents. It's designed specifically by a nutritionist who specializes in geriatric. I don't want it. I want real food. There's dead silence in the room. I look around. All eyes are trained on me. What? I say loudly. Is that so much to ask? Doesn't anyone else here miss real food? Surely you can't all be happy with this. This. Pap! I put my hand on the edge of my plate and give it a shove. Just a little one. Really. My plate shoots across the table and crashes to the floor. Dr. Rashid is summoned. She sits at my bedside and asks questions that I try to answer courteously, but I'm so tired of being treated as though I'm unreasonable that I'm afraid I may come off as a bit crotchety. After a half hour, she asks the nurse to come into the hallway with her. I strain to hear, but my old ears, for all their obscene hugeness, pick up nothing but snippets. Serious, serious depression, and manifesting as aggression, not uncommon in geriatric patients. I'm not deaf, you know, I shout from my bed. Just old. Dr. Rashid peers in at me and takes the nurse's elbow. They move down the hall and out of earshot. That night, a new pill appears in my paper cup. The pills are already in my palm before I notice it. What's this? I ask, pushing it around. I flip it over and inspect the other side. What? Says the nurse. This, I say, poking the offending pill. This one right here. It's new. It's called Elavil. What's it for? It's going to help you feel better. What's it for? I repeat. She doesn't answer. I look up. Our eyes meet. Depression, she says finally. I won't take it. Mr. Jankowski, I'm not depressed. Dr. Rashid prescribed it. It's going to... You want to drug me. You want to turn me into a jello-eating sheep. I won't take it, I tell you. Mr. Jankowski, I have 12 other patients to take care of. Now please take your pills. I thought we were residents. Every one of her pinched features hardens. I'll take the others, but not this, I say, flicking the pill from my hand. It flies through the air and lands on the floor. I toss the others into my mouth. Where's my water? I say, my words garbled, because I'm trying to keep the pills on the center of my tongue. She hands me a plastic cup, retrieves the pill from the floor, and goes into my bathroom. I hear a flush. Then she comes back. Mr. Jankowski, I am going to get another Elavil, and if you won't take it, I will call Dr. Rashid, and she will prescribe an injectable instead. Either way, you are taking the Elavil. How you do so is up to you. When she brings me the pill, I swallow it. A quarter of an hour later, I also get an injection. Not of Elavil, of something else. But still, it doesn't seem fair because I took that damn pill. Within minutes, I am a jello-eating sheep. Well, a sheep at any rate. But because I keep reminding myself of the incident that brought this misfortune upon me, I realize that if someone brought pockmarked jello right now and told me to eat it, I would. What have they done to me? I cling to my anger with every ounce of humanity left in my ruined body. But it's no use. It slips away like a wave from shore. I am pondering this sad fact when I realize the blackness of sleep is circling my head. It's been there a while, biding its time and growing closer with each revolution. I give up on rage, which at this point has become a formality, and make a mental note to get angry again in the morning. Then I let myself drift, because there's really no fighting it.
Chapter 6.
The train groans, straining against the increasing resistance of air brakes. After several minutes and a final prolonged shriek, the great iron beast shudders to a stop and exhales. Kinko throws back his blanket and stands up. He's no more than 4 feet tall, if that. He stretches, yawns, and smacks his lips. Then scratches his head, armpits, and testicles. The dog dances around his feet, her stump of a tail wagging furiously.
Come on, Queenie, he says, scooping her up. You want to go outside? Queenie, go outside?
He plants a kiss in the middle of her brown and white head and crosses the little room. I watch from my crumpled horse blanket in the corner. Kinko, I say. If it weren't for the vehemence with which he slams the door, I might think he didn't hear me. We are on a side rail behind the flying squadron, which has obviously been here a few hours. The tent city has already risen, to the delight of the crowd of townspeople hanging around watching. Rows of children sit on top of the flying squadron, surveying the lot with shining eyes. Their parents congregate beneath, holding the hands of younger siblings and pointing to various marvels appearing in front of them. The workmen from the main train climb down from the sleeper cars, light cigarettes, and trek across the lot toward the cookhouse. Its blue and orange flag is already flying, and the boiler beside it belches steam, bearing cheerful witness to the breakfast within. Performers emerge from sleepers closer to the back of the train and of obviously better quality. There's a clear hierarchy. The closer to the back, the more impressive the quarters. Uncle Al himself climbs from a car right in front of the caboose. I can't help but notice that Kinko and I are the human occupants closest to the engine. Jacob, I turn. August strides toward me, his shirt crisp, his chin scraped smooth. His slick hair bears the recent impression of a comb.
How are we this morning, my boy? He asks.
All right, I say. A little tired.
Did that little troll give you any trouble?
No, I say. He was fine.
Good, good.
He claps his hands together.
Shall we have a look at that horse, then? I doubt it's anything serious. Marlena coddles them terribly. Oh, here's the little lady now. Come here, darling, he calls brightly. I want you to meet Jacob. He's a fan of yours.
I feel a blush creep across my face. She comes to a stop beside him, smiling up at me as August turns toward the stock car.
It's a pleasure to meet you,
she says, extending her hand. Up close, she still looks remarkably like Catherine. Delicate features, pale as porcelain, with a smattering of freckles across the bridge of her nose. Shimmering blue eyes, and hair just dark enough to disqualify as blonde.
The pleasure is mine, I say, painfully aware that I haven't shaved in 2 days.
My clothes are stiff with manure, and that manure is not the only unpleasant scent rising from my body.
She cocks her head slightly. Say, you're the one I saw yesterday, aren't you? In the menagerie.
I don't think so, I say, lying instinctively.
Sure you are, right before the show when the chimp den slammed shut.
I glanced at August, but he's still facing the other way. She follows my gaze and seems to understand.
You're not from Boston, are you?
She says, her voice lowered.
No, I've never been.
Huh,
she says.
It's just you look familiar somehow. Oh, well,
she continues brightly.
August says you're a vet.
At the sound of his name, August spins around. No, I say. I mean, not exactly.
He's being modest, says August. Pete! Hey, Pete!
A group of men stand in front of the stock car's door, attaching a ramp with built-in sides. A tall one with dark hair turns.
Yeah, boss, he says. Get the others unloaded and bring out Silver Star, will you?
Sure. 11 horses later, 5 white and 6 black, Pete goes inside the stock car once again. Moment later, he's back.
Silver Star don't want to move, boss.
Make him, says August.
Oh, no, you don't, says Marlena, shooting August a dirty look.
She marches up the ramp and disappears. August and I wait outside, listening to passionate entreaties and tongue clicks. After several minutes, she reappears in the doorway with the silver-maned Arabian. Marlena steps out in front of him, clicking and murmuring. He raises his head and pulls back. Eventually, he follows her down the ramp, his head bobbing deeply with each step. At the bottom, he pulls back so hard he almost sits on his haunches.
Jesus, Marlena, I thought you said he was a bit off, says August.
Marlena is ashen.
He was. He wasn't anything like this bad yesterday. He's been a bit lame for a few days, but nothing like this.
She clicks and tugs until the horse finally steps onto the gravel. He stands with his back hunched, his hind legs bearing as much weight as they can. My heart sinks. It's the classic walking on eggshell stance.
What do you think it is? Says August.
Give me a minute, I say, although I'm already 99% sure.
Do you have hoof testers?
No, but the smithy does. Do you want me to send Pete?
Not yet. I might not need them. I crouch beside the horse's left shoulder and run my hands down his leg, from shoulder to fetlock. He doesn't flinch. Then I lay my hand across the front of his hoof. It's radiating heat. I place my thumb and forefinger on the back of his fetlock. His arterial pulse is pounding.
Damn, I say.
What is it?
Says Marlena. I straighten up and reach for Silver Star's foot. He leaves it firmly on the ground.
Come on, boy, I say, pulling on his hoof.
Eventually he lifts it. The sole is bulging and dark, with a red line running around the edge. I set it down immediately. This horse is foundering, I say.
Oh, dear God,
says Marlena, clapping a hand to her mouth.
What?
Says August.
He's what?
Foundering, I say. It's when the connective tissues between the hoof and the coffin bone are compromised and the coffin bone rotates toward the sole of the hoof.
In English, please. Is it bad?
I glance at Marlena, who is still covering her mouth.
Yes, I say. Can you fix it?
We can bed him up real thick and try to keep him off his feet. Grass hay only and no grain and no work.
But can you fix it?
I hesitate, glancing quickly at Marlena.
Probably not.
August stares at Silver Star and exhales through puffed cheeks.
Well, 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 booms an unmistakable voice from behind us. If it isn't our very own animal doctor.
Uncle Al floats toward us in black and white checkered pants and a crimson vest. He carries a silver-topped cane, which he swings extravagantly with each step. A handful of people straggle behind him.
So what says the croaker? Did you sort out the horse? He asks jovially, coming to a stop in front of me.
Not exactly, I say.
Why not?
Apparently he's foundering, says August.
He's what? Says Uncle Al.
It's his feet. Uncle Al bends over, peering at Silver Star's feet.
They look fine to me.
They're not, I say. He turns to me.
So what do you propose to do about it?
Put him on stall rest and cut his grain. Other than that, there's not much we can do.
Stall rest is out of the question. He's the lead horse in the Liberty Act.
If this horse keeps working, his coffin bone will rotate until it punctures his soul, and then you'll lose him, I say unequivocally. Uncle Al's eyelids flicker. He looks over at Marlena.
How long will he be out?
I pause, choosing my next words carefully. Possibly for good.
God damn it!
He shouts, stabbing his cane into the earth.
Where the hell am I supposed to get another Liberty horse mid-season?
He looks around at his followers. They shrug, mumble, and avert their gazes.
Useless sons of bitches. Why do I even keep you? Okay, you.
He points his cane at me.
You're on. Fix this horse. $9 a week. You answer to August. Lose this horse, and you're out of here. In fact, first hint of trouble, and you're out of here.
He steps forward to Marlena and pats her shoulder.
There, there, my dear, he says kindly. Don't fret. Jacob here will take good care of him. August, go get this little girl some breakfast, will you? We have to hit the road.
August's head jerks around.
What do you mean, hit the road?
We're tearing down, says Uncle Al, gesturing vaguely. Moving along.
What the hell are you talking about? We just got here. We're still setting up.
Change of plans, August. Change of plans.
Uncle Al and his followers walk away. August stares after them, his mouth open wide. Rumors abound in the cookhouse. In front of the hash browns.
Carson Brothers got caught shortchanging a few weeks ago. Burned the territory.
Huh, snorts somebody else.
That's usually our job.
In front of the scrambled eggs.
They heard he was carrying booze. There's gonna be a raid.
There's gonna be a raid, all right,
comes the reply.
But it's on account of the cooch tent, not the booze.
In front of the oatmeal.
Uncle Al stiffed the sheriff on the lot fee last year. Cops say we got 2 hours before they run us out.
Ezra is slouched in the same position as yesterday, his arms crossed and his chin pressed into his chest. He pays me no attention whatever.
Whoa there, big fella, says August as I head for the canvas divider. Where do you think you're going?
To the other side.
Nonsense, he says. You're the show's vet. Come with me. Although I must say I'm tempted to send you over there just to find out what they're saying.
I follow August and Marlena to one of the nicely dressed tables. Kinko sits a few tables over, with the three other dwarves and Queenie at his feet. She looks up hopefully, her tongue lolling off to the side. Kinko ignores her and everyone else at his table. He stares straight at me, his jaw moving grimly from side to side.
Eat, darling, says August, pushing a bowl of sugar toward Marlena's porridge. There's no point fretting. We've got a bona fide veterinarian here.
I open my mouth to protest, then shut it again. A petite blonde approaches.
Marlena, sweetie, you'll never guess what I heard.
Hi, Lottie, says Marlena.
I have no idea what's up.
Lottie slides in beside Marlena and talks nonstop, almost without pausing for breath. She's an aerialist, and she got the straight scoop from a good authority. Her spotter heard Uncle Al and the advance man exchanging heated words outside the bake top. Before long, a crowd surrounds our table, and between Lottie and the tidbits tossed out by our audience, I hear what amounts to a crash course on the history of Alan J. Bunkle and the Benzini Brothers' most spectacular show on Earth. Uncle Al is a buzzard, a vulture, an eater of carrion. 15 years ago, he was the manager of a mud show,
a ragtag group of pellagra-riddled performers dragged from town to town by miserable thrush-hoofed horses. In August of 1928, through no fault of Wall Street, the Benzini brothers' most spectacular show on Earth collapsed. They simply ran out of money and couldn't make the jump to the next town, never mind back to winter quarters. The general manager caught a train out of town and left everything behind, people, equipment, and animals. Uncle Al had the good fortune to be in the vicinity and was able to score a sleeping car and two flats for a song from railroad officials desperate to free up their siding. Those two flats easily held his few decrepit wagons, and because the train cars were already emblazoned with Benzini Brothers' most spectacular show on Earth, Alan Bunkle retained the name and officially joined the ranks of train circuses. When the crash came, larger circuses started going down, and Uncle Al could hardly believe his luck. It started with the Gentry Brothers and Buck Jones in 1929. The next year saw the end of the Cole Brothers, the Christie Brothers, and the mighty John Robinson. And every time a show closed, there was Uncle Al, sopping up the remains. A few train cars, a handful of stranded performers, a tiger or a camel. He had scouts everywhere. The moment a larger circus showed signs of trouble, Uncle Al would get a telegram and race to the scene. He grew fat off their carcasses. In Minneapolis, he picked up 6 parade wagons and a toothless lion. In Ohio, a sword swallower and a flat car. In Des Moines, a dressing tent, a hippopotamus and matching wagon, and the lovely Lucinda. In Portland, 18 draft horses, 2 zebras, and a smithy. In Seattle, 2 bunk cars and a bona fide freak, a bearded lady, and this made him happy. For what Uncle Al craves above all else, what Uncle Al dreams of at night, are freaks. Not made freaks. Not men covered head to toe with tattoos. Not women who regurgitate wallets and light bulbs on command. Not moss-haired girls or men who pound steaks into their sinus cavities. Uncle Al craves real freaks. Born freaks. And that is the reason for our detour to Joliet. The Fox Brothers Circus has just collapsed, and Uncle Al is ecstatic because they employed the world-famous Charles Mansfield Livingston, a handsome, dapper man with a parasitic twin growing out of his chest. He calls it Chaz. It looks like an infant with its head buried in his ribcage. He dresses it in miniature suits with black patent shoes on its feet, and when Charles walks, he holds its little hands in his. Rumor has it that Chaz's tiny penis even gets erections. Uncle Al is desperate to get there before someone else snaps him up. And so despite the fact that our posters are all over Saratoga Springs, despite the fact that it was supposed to be a 2-day stop and we've just had 2,200 loaves of bread, 116 pounds of butter, 360 dozen eggs, 1,570 pounds of meat, 11 cases of sauerkraut, 105 pounds of sugar, 24 crates of oranges, 52 pounds of lard, 1,200 pounds of vegetables, and 212 cans of coffee delivered to the lot, despite the tons of hay and turnips and beets and other food for the animals that is piled out back of the menagerie tent, despite the hundreds of townspeople gathered at the edge of the lot right now, first in excitement, and then in bewilderment, and now in fast-growing anger, despite all this, we are tearing down and moving out. The cook is apoplectic. The advance man is threatening to quit. The boss hostler is furious, whacking the beleaguered men of the flying squadron with flagrant abandon. Everyone here has been down this route before. Mostly they're worried they won't be fed enough during the 3-day journey to Joliet. The cookhouse crew are doing their best, scrabbling to haul as much food as they can back to the main train and promising to hand out dookies, apparently some kind of boxed meal, at the first opportunity. When August learns we have a 3-day jump in front of us, he lets loose a string of curses, then strides back and forth, damning Uncle Al to hell and barking orders at the rest of us. While we haul food for the animals back to the train, August goes off to try to persuade, and if necessary, to bribe the cookhouse steward into parting with some of the food meant for humans.
Diamond Joe and I carry buckets of offal from behind the menagerie to the main train. It's from the local stockyards, and it's repulsive. Smelly, bloody, and charred. We put the buckets just inside the entrance of the stock cars. The inhabitants, camels, zebras, and other hay burners, kick and fuss and make all manner of protest. But they're going to have to travel with the meat because there is no other place to put it. The big cats travel on top of the flat cars and parade dens. When we're finished, I go looking for August. He's behind the cookhouse, loading a wheelbarrow with the odds and ends he's managed to beg off the cookhouse crew. We're pretty much loaded, I say. Should we do anything about water? Dump and refill the buckets. They've loaded the water wagon, but it won't last 3 days. We'll have to stop along the way. Uncle Al may be a tough old crow, but he's no fool. He won't risk the animals. No animals, no circus. There's all the meat on board. As much as will fit. Priority goes to the meat. If you have to toss off hay to make room, do it. Cats are worth more than hay burners. We're packed to the gills. Unless Kinko and I sleep somewhere else, there's no room for anything else. August pauses, tapping his pursed lips. No, he says finally. Marlena would never tolerate meat on board with her horses. At least I know where I stand, even if it is somewhere below the cats. The water at the bottom of the horses' buckets is murky and has oats floating in it. But it's water all the same, so I carry the buckets outside, remove my shirt, and dump what's left over my arms, head, and chest. Feeling a little less than fresh, Doc? Says August. I'm leaning over with water dripping from my hair. I wipe both eyes clear and stand up. Sorry, I didn't see any other water to use, and I was just going to dump it anyway. No, quite right, quite right. We can hardly expect our vet to live like a working man, can we? I'll tell you what, Jacob. It's a little late now, but when we get to Joliet, I'll arrange for you to start getting your own water. Performers and bosses get 2 buckets apiece. More if you're willing to grease the waterman's palm, he says, rubbing his fingers and thumb. I'll also set you up with the Monday man and see about getting you another set of clothes.
The Monday man?
What day did your mother do the washing, Jacob?
I stare at him. Surely you don't mean...
All that wash hanging up on lines. It would be a shame to let it go to waste.
But
never you mind, Jacob. If you don't want to know the answer to a question, don't ask. And don't use that slime to clean up. Follow me.
He leads me back across the lot to one of only 3 tents left standing. Inside are hundreds of buckets lined up 2 deep in front of trunks and clothes racks, with names or initials painted on the sides. Men in various states of undress are using them to bathe and shave.
Here, he says, pointing at a pair of buckets. Use these.
But what about Walter? I ask, reading the name from the side of one of them.
Oh, I know Walter. He'll understand. Got a razor?
No.
I have some back there, he says, pointing across the tent. At the far end. They're labeled with my name. Hurry up, though. I'm guessing we'll be out of here in another 30 minutes.
Thanks, I say.
Don't mention it, he says. I'll leave a shirt for you in the stock car.
When I return to the stock car, Silver Star is against the far wall in knee-deep straw. His eyes are glassy, his heart rate high. The other horses are still outside, so I get my first good look at the place. It has 16 standing stalls, which are formed by dividers that swing across after each horse is let in. If the car hadn't been adulterated for the mysterious and missing goats, it would hold 32 horses. I find a clean white shirt laid across the end of Kinko's cot. I strip out of my old one and toss it onto the horse blanket in the corner. Before I put the new shirt on, I bring it to my nose, grateful for the scent of laundry soap. As I'm buttoning it, Kinko's books catch my eye. They're sitting on the crate beside the kerosene lamp. I tuck in my shirt, sit on the cot, and reach for the top one. It's the complete works of Shakespeare. Underneath is a collection of Wordsworth poems, a Bible, and a book of plays by Oscar Wilde.
A few small comic books are hidden inside the front cover of the Shakespeare. I recognize them immediately. They're 8-pagers. I flip one open. A crudely drawn Olive Oil lies on a bed with her legs open, naked but for her shoes. She spreads herself with her fingers. Popeye appears in a thought bubble above her head, with a bulging erection that reaches to his chin. Wimpy, with an equally enormous erection, peers through the window.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
I drop the comic, then bend quickly to retrieve it.
Just leave it the hell alone,
says Kinko, storming over and snatching it from my hands.
And get the hell off my bed.
I leap up.
Look here, pal,
he says, reaching up to jab his finger into my chest.
I'm not exactly thrilled about having to bunk with you, but apparently I don't have a choice in the matter. But you better believe I have a choice about whether you mess with my stuff.
He's unshaven, his blue eyes burning in a face that is the color of beets.
You're right, I stammer. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have touched your things. Listen, pisshead, I had a nice gig going here until you came along. Plus, I'm in a bad mood anyway. Some asshole used my water today, so you'd best stay out of my way. I may be short, but don't think I can't take you.
My eyes widen. I recover, but not soon enough. His eyes narrow to slits. He scans the shirt, my clean-shaven face. He chucks the 8-pager into his cot.
Oh, hell. Haven't you done enough already?
I'm sorry. Honest to God, I didn't know it was yours. August said I could use it.
Did he also say he could go through my stuff?
I pause, embarrassed. No. He gathers his books and stuffs them into the crate. Kinko, Walter, I'm sorry.
That's Kinko to you, pal. Only my friends call me Walter.
I walk to the corner and sink down on my horse blanket. Kinko helps Queenie onto the bed and lies down beside her, staring so pointedly at the ceiling I half expect it to start smoldering. Before long, the train pulls out. A few dozen angry men chase us for a while, swinging pitchforks and baseball bats, although it's mostly for the benefit of the tale they'll get to tell at dinner tonight. If they had really wanted a fight, there was plenty of time before we pulled out. It's not that I can't see their point. Their wives and children had been looking forward to the circus for days, and they themselves had probably been looking forward to some of the other entertainments rumored to be available in the back of our lot. And now, instead of sampling the charms of the magnificent Barbara, they'll have to content themselves with their 8-pagers. I can see why a guy might get steamed. Kinko and I clatter along in hostile silence as the train gets up to speed. He lies on his cot, reading. Queenie rests her head on his socks. Mostly she sleeps, but whenever she's awake, she watches me. I sit on the horse blanket, bone-weary, but not yet tired enough to lie down and suffer the indignities of vermin and mildew. At what should be dinner time, I get up and stretch. Kinko's eyes dart over from behind his book and then back to the text. I walk out to the horses and stand looking over their alternating black and white backs. When we reloaded them, we moved everyone up to give Silver Star all 4 empty stalls worth of space. Even though the rest of the horses are now in unfamiliar slots, they seem largely unperturbed, probably because we loaded them in the same order. The names scratched into the posts no longer match the occupants, but I can extrapolate who's who. The 4th horse in is Blackie. I wonder if his personality is anything like his human namesakes. I can't see Silver Star, which means he must be lying down. That's both good and bad. Good, because it keeps the weight off his feet, and bad, because it means he's in enough pain he doesn't want to stand. Because of the way the stalls are constructed, I can't check on him until we stop and unload the other horses. I sit across from the open door and watch the landscape pass until it gets dark. Eventually, I slide down and fall asleep. Seems like only minutes later when the brakes begin screeching. Almost immediately, the door to the goat room opens, and Kinko and Queenie come out into the rough foyer. Kinko leans one shoulder against the wall, hands pushed deep in his pockets and ignoring me studiously. When we finally come to a stop, he jumps to the ground, turns, and claps twice. Queenie leaps into his arms, and they disappear. I climb to my feet and peer out the open door. We're on a siding in the middle of nowhere.
The other two sections of train are also stopped, stretched out before us on the track a half mile between each. People climb down from the train in the early morning light. The performers stretch, grumbling.